The ABC Radio Network presents, transcribed, I, the Diplomat.
How do you do, ladies and gentlemen? This is Michael Redgrave speaking.
This is James Mason.
Basil Rathbone, at your service.
This is Albert Decker.
This is Orson Welles.
And this is Edward Everett Horton.
The story you're about to hear never happened, yet it is true. It is a fictional account, yet authentic. It is the autobiography of a man who never lived, yet who has lived a million lives under a thousand names in 100 countries through a score of centuries. This special program, I, the Diplomat, is brought to you by UN Radio to commemorate the United Nations' 11th anniversary and to honor the United Nations' way to a better standard of life in larger freedom for all, the way of negotiation, the way of the conference table, the way of the diplomat.
I, the diplomat. This is my story. If you permit, I'll look back upon my historic years and let a thousand dead yesterdays breathe again and call back to life the ghosts of long-buried sounds. My name? I have had many names at many times and many places. In Sanskrit, men have called me
Rajadut.
In Hebrew,
Shagrir.
Chinese,
Pash.
Greek,
Diplomati.
Persian,
Safir.
Latin,
Legatus.
French,
Le Plenipotentiaire.
Italian,
Ambasciatore Residente.
And then, of course,
His Excellency, the Ambassador.
Thank you, gentlemen. You bring back many memories, rich in nostalgia and with eventfulness. As you have heard, through my crowded years, I have been known by many names in many tongues. And through the years, I've received much advice on how I should behave, what qualities I should develop, and what purposes I should serve.
May I?
Yes, go right ahead.
In my opinion, the negotiator must possess the patience of a watchmaker.
François de Calais, 17th century, French citizen.
He must have a calm nature, be able to suffer all fools gladly, and should not be given to drink, to gambling, to women, irritability, or any other wayward humors, a fantasy.
Would you gentlemen care to hear the woman's point of view? My views on the qualifications of a diplomat?
Your Imperial Highness, we are honored.
Well, then,
the Princess of Zerbst, mother of Empress Catherine of Russia.
A diplomat must be handsome, young, tall, and with a nice, smooth skin.
Charming, madame. But I believe you are missing the point. There's not only the diplomat's skin, but also his methods, which must be nice and smooth.
Ladies and gentlemen, Sri Kautilya, one of India's most famous ministers, 4th century before Christ.
As I have explained in my famous treatise on the subject, it is my considered view that the duties of a diplomat are to gain friends, make intrigue, gather information, carry away by stealth their relatives and gems, and generally sow dissension.
I cannot agree with that.
The Prime Minister is absolutely correct.
No.
I cannot agree with that at all. Impossible.
Yes, indeed, I have received much advice in my time, and it's frequently been quite conflicting, as you have seen. Now, all good biographies begin with the place and date of birth. I feel sure that I came into existence at a time so remote that time itself had not yet been discovered. My first recollections date back to those dark and cavernous centuries when the species Homo was not yet quite sapiens. You see, we were then known as the Neanderthal men, though perhaps the word men was still a bit of premature politeness. We used to live in caves, damp caves, in small family groups. Each group being ruled by the oldest among us, whom we used to know affectionately as the old man. Now, this old man was quite dictatorial in many ways. For example, he had a tendency to keep all the women to himself. But food was also necessary, and this is where the old man proved his value, for he was responsible for organizing the prowling parties that went out at night in search of food. As I recall it, one day, the old man of our family group thought it might be a good idea to send a couple of us as envoys to the family group next door. Next cave. Our mission was to reach agreement so that we didn't invade each other's preserves. And when I returned from the mission...
Oh, drat.
I saluted the old man with our Neanderthal equivalent of... Gesundheit.
Well, how did you make out?
Well, sir, I...
Speak up, Small. Speak up. Did they accept our terms?
Well, we really didn't get around to discussing terms, as it were.
What do you mean you didn't get around to discussing terms, as it were? Where's the other envoy who went with you? Maybe I can get some more sense out of him.
I'm sorry, but he's not here anymore.
Not here? What happened?
They ate him. As you see, the beginnings of my profession were somewhat disturbing. Fortunately, however, edibility soon ceased to be a necessary qualification of a diplomat. Our ancestors soon realized that these were unrewarding methods of negotiation, and it was generally agreed by all that I should not be eaten while on a mission. Diplomatic immunity had begun. One of the earliest injunctions against killing me was put on record in the India of Vedic times.
The king who slays an envoy sends himself to hell with all his ministers.
Nicely put. Since few wanted to go to hell, if they could avoid it, it became the general practice for men to spare my life, even though they had occasion to be displeased with my activities. Unfortunately, however, there was a rider to the early Indian injunctions against the killing of diplomats, a clause in fine print, so to speak.
While an envoy may not be killed, he may be suitably punished, if offensive, by such means as the cropping of the hair, mutilation, or the causing of deformity in the limbs.
I must confess, I found those times rather trying. I recall with distaste, for example, what happened to a couple of my colleagues who were sent by Justin II to negotiate with the Seljuk Turks. It was decided that my friends needed to be purified, and for this purpose, they were put into the hands of the tribal wizards.
Is everything ready?
I think so.
Incense?
Yes.
Hot coals?
Yes.
Terrifying masks?
Yes.
Acrid vapors?
The best.
Monkey's paws?
Half a dozen.
Oh, splendid. Bring in the foreign envoys and let the ceremonies begin.
In course of time, I'm happy to say, things improved, and the processes of diplomatic purification became less arduous. For example, envoys to the court of the Tatar Khans merely had to pass through fire before being admitted into his royal presence. Several survived this sterilization. In the present times, there's been a further relaxation of the taboo against the foreign envoy, and the purifying procedures are appreciably milder in their effects on ambassadorial life and limb. But I must get back to my biography. My first job in historic times, when men established the first civilizations, was that of a herald, a messenger from city to city and people to people. In this capacity, I was particularly in demand in ancient Greece. In the days of Homer, the qualities required of me were still modest. I just had to develop a loud voice and a retentive memory. I set about acquiring these virtues with professional gusto.
All right, son, you will recite Book 24, The Odyssey.
Now through the city, meantime, swiftly ran the rumor that the suitors all had met a bloody death. No sooner had men heard...
Louder!
No sooner had men heard the tidings than they came with cries and moans before the palace, moving to and fro.
Louder! Louder!
Each carried forth his dead and gave to each his funeral rites.
Louder!
Except for those who came from distant cities. I passed. I became a herald. Soon, however, I began to find that I would need to add other qualifications to my equipment as a professional if I meant to hold on to my job. City life in ancient Greece was developing, and with it, my career had to develop also. The Greek city-states realized that they were interdependent and needed the understanding and goodwill of one another. They set up regional councils and assemblies to discuss common problems and take common decisions. It was my job to appear before these popular democratic gatherings and plead the cause of my own city-state. I had to become an orator. At this stage of my career, the one thing demanded of me, above all else, was that I make...
A magnificent speech. Really magnificent. If you succeed, you will be rewarded with the customary garlands of wild olives and a free meal at the town hall. We may even put up a stone tablet to commemorate your success.
But if I don't succeed?
If you don't succeed, I need not remind you that the city has the power to impose grave penalties.
I'm glad that I lived through those days. As a Greek, I, the diplomat, was privileged to take part in an historic experiment of a new principle. The interests of a part are best served by the interests of the whole. The heritage and the power of Greece passed on to Rome. I passed on with it. As a civis Romanus, a citizen of Rome, I lived through proud centuries of peace and progress. I shared in the glories of the time, even though as a professional I was almost unemployed. My fellow citizens did much to bring law and order to the world. But it was, after all, Roman law and Latin order. The Roman instructions were brief and uncomplicated.
All you have to do is to demand an audience in the name of Rome. If the audience is refused, we go to war. If the audience is granted, you will give them our terms for peace. If they do not accept these terms within 48 hours, we go to war.
For centuries, this system worked quite well. But it couldn't last. It didn't. The need for my professional services was to arise again. It did. History took a fresh turn. The Roman Empire collapsed. Both in the East and West, there emerged a number of autonomous nations. Submission gave place to competition. It now became a question of adjusting the rival ambitions of the several tribal kingdoms that emerged from the fragments of a broken empire. In this unsettled situation, with its anxious struggles for life and death, my profession naturally acquired a new importance. Life was compelling me to develop new qualities. Now I, the diplomat, had to become a trained observer. It was now necessary that I should be able to gather, assess, and analyze information concerning the ambitions, weaknesses, and resources of uneasy rivals. I was now expected to cultivate the art of making friends and influencing enemies. I inquired where I could best obtain these new skills and attributes. I was told to go to Constantinople. I was not the only one who came to Constantinople. It seemed as if the whole world had flocked there. And in a sense, of course, it had. The city lay astride the crossroads of time and of history. It was the hub of mercantile and diplomatic activity from east and west. Men came to it from all the directions where the four winds blow. They came to talk of caliphs, kings, and the cost of cabbages. I rubbed elbows with men dressed in every conceivable fashion of the day and every imaginable color. Beggars crossed the path of princes.
Come closer, one and all. Feast your eyes upon this nymph of the eastern sea. Her eyes are as soft as the first rays of light on a summer dawn, and her hair is as dark as the parting of friends. Upon her cheeks there lives the blush of a newborn rose, and her lips are as red as a pomegranate wound. Not in another 100 moons will you ever set eyes upon beauty so rare. Surely there is among you a prince, a nobleman.
I was a student. My resources were limited. I could barely meet my tuition fees at the School of Diplomacy in Constantinople, which I had come to attend. I dragged myself there. Now, this school was one of the special institutions established by the Byzantine emperors to give professional training in the new attributes, functions, and refinements of diplomacy. I had already learned a lot in the first term, believe me.
Now, gentlemen, we enter upon the second term of our diplomatic course. But first, let us review the syllabus of our last term, Aims and Objectives of Imperial Policy. Now, who can tell me what these aims and objectives are? You there, Nikephoros Hookers.
The aims of Byzantine imperial policy basically are three.
Good. Enumerate them.
First, to weaken the barbarians by fomenting rivalry among them.
Good for him.
Second, to purchase the friendship of frontier tribes and peoples by subsidies and flattery. And third.
Go on.
The third aim of imperial policy is to...
Report to my study after school. You may sit down. You there, Porphyrogenitus.
I rose to my feet.
Now, tell the class what the third aim of our imperial policy is.
It is to convert the heathen to the Christian faith.
Good. And how must an ambassador proceed towards accomplishing these three aims?
He must always be studiously polite. He must never criticize foreigners, even if he doesn't like them. And he must remember that it is his duty to deceive and dissimulate.
Admirable, my boy. Admirable. You will go far. Class recessed. Nikephoros Hookers.
Yes, sir?
Kindly follow me to my study.
Oh!
As you can see, no pains were spared to equip us well for our job. I might add that I was among those exceptional students who graduated with honors. I was immediately offered a job with a special department which had been set up in Constantinople to handle foreign affairs. The department was appropriately called the Skrinion Barbaron, or the Bureau for the Barbarians. Let me introduce my chief.
Thank you. I am the head of the Skrinion Barbaron. You may call me, if it is more convenient, Minister for the Barbarians. Our duties at the Bureau, you understand, were properly to receive and duly to deceive envoys accredited to the Emperor's court. I needn't tell you I always did my job well. On one occasion, I even surpassed myself. We were expecting some Arabian envoys, and I had some especially good tidings for the Emperor's private ear. We were at the royal table the night before. I remember the evening well. The hall was crowded with nobles who watched the Emperor carefully, eager to follow his every wish, his every turn of mood. His Majesty was impatient with one of the servants.
Don't spill it, you fool! Now leave the wine pitcher and go away. Go away!
Now,
you were saying?
About the Arabian envoys, Your Majesty.
Ah, yes. When did you say they arrived?
Tomorrow, after cockcrow, sire.
You made the usual arrangements, I suppose?
With improvements, sire.
Good.
All three stages of the reception have been greatly improved.
Really? Oh, pass me that lamb leg, will you? And a goop of that pistachio stuffing.
Oh, my. Oh, dear, dear. Yes, 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 of course.
Also some of those grape leaves. Mm? Oh, they're pickled, you know. I believe in noisy eating, my dear fellow.
So I hear.
Why be quiet about that which we relish with gusto?
I have never tried relish with gusto. I must do it sometime.
Now, you were talking about improvement. What improvements?
My, this is good. Well, to begin with, sire, the guard of honor which we customarily give to our guests will this time be composed entirely of the secret police.
I like that. I like that. That's good. That's good. Since they're here to spy, we'll outspy them, eh? You're earning your keep, my dear boy. I must increase your per diem to 50 groptings a day.
Majesty. As for the second stage of the reception, sire,
yeah?
The commander of the Imperial forces has come up with a brilliant idea.
He has?
With my help, naturally.
Well, quite.
For making the customary military parade even more imposing.
Ah, that's of exquisite importance.
Precisely, Your Majesty.
Ah.
Accordingly, arrangements have been made this time to have each company pass before the ambassadorial review stand at least three times.
Three times? The same men? Now, won't they get to be a bore?
The same men, my emperor. But not the same clothes.
Ah, you truly are a minister of subtleties.
Oh, Majesty, you're most gracious.
Oh, yes, yes, I am there.
You see, sire, as each company marches past the review stand, it will return on the double to the barracks, rapidly change into new uniforms, equip itself with new weapons, and make another appearance before our foreign guests.
Now, what about the audience which I'm giving to the envoys next week? Didn't you say you had improvements for that also?
Indeed, yes, sire.
Good.
For that occasion, I have reserved our most ingenious stratagem.
You have? Tell me, you clever fellow.
I've engineered the construction of a most cunning contraption.
Yes?
Sire, a lever has been devised which, when placed behind your imperial throne and manipulated by hands unseen, will cause the throne, with your majesty in it, of course, to be lifted high, as if by magic.
You don't say. Oh, is it safe?
Impeccably.
What a relief.
Consider, sire, the bewilderment, the respect that this will induce in the envoy.
Yes, it might.
After they have made their first obeisance during the royal audience, they will lift their eyes and behold, they will find that your imperial majesty has been miraculously elevated since first observed.
That should raise my personal prestige, eh?
Yeah.
I don't know why these nobles of mine have to be such sheep. Laughing when I laugh, frowning when I frown. Disgusting to be surrounded by yes-men all the time, is it not?
No, Your Majesty.
What?
Yes, Your Majesty.
Good.
Such was the sinuous diplomacy of Byzantine days. Such were the devious ways of statecraft that I had to serve and survive. My profession in these centuries was set in a crafty mold which endured for many centuries to come. I endured with it. I had to. The world needed my skill, though not yet my conscience. That was to come later. For the moment, what had been started in cunning Constantinople was refined, polished, and perfected in a city to the west, Venice. It was there that I, the diplomat, underwent my next major reincarnation. It was there that my profession took on much of its modern aspect. The Italy of the 13th and 14th centuries, you recall, was split into several city-states. Each city-state had interests in common with all others, but at the same time, it feared all others. Conditions called for active diplomacy. Rivalry, competition, and the need for building protective alliances made my services indispensable. Venice became the first to put my profession on an efficient, modern, organized basis. And to the Duke of Milan went the credit for naming the first permanent embassy. Italy thus took a big step forward in the evolution of my career. Unfortunately, however, while the Italian contribution to diplomatic practice was great, its contribution to diplomatic ethics was still questionable. Let me demonstrate. I had been named resident ambassador to Genoa. While my wife was busy packing, I went calling on the Duke for final instructions. The Duke was at his daily sword practice with one of his courtiers.
Now, there you are, Ambassadore. An excellent moment for you to appear. Diplomacy, my dear Ambassadore, is like a sharp sword in the head of a master. The objective, of course, is to maintain your own freedom of movement and to keep your opponent on the defensive. So, you are familiar with the axioms of Vigiani, the master swordsman?
I regret to say, my prince, that my knowledge of Vigiani is limited.
Watch closely, then. You have five ways of thrusting at your opponent. There is a thrust from the right, the punta dritta. Then there is the thrust from the left, the punta reversa. And then there is the punta discendente. It comes down like this. No, that was not good. So, good boy. The punta ascendente goes upward, like this. You may also thrust horizontally, the punta ferma, most effective, like this. Ha! And finally, there is the lunge, the unanswerable punta sopramano.
A hit, my lord.
And that is diplomacy. You may leave me. Here, take my sword with you. Pick it up, you clumsy oaf. You better get your wound rest. Well, Ambassadore, I think there is little to add. Remember, always get your man first. If you don't, he will probably get you.
I shall bear that in mind, my prince.
Always maintain your poise. Like a good swordsman, always keep a cool head. Assess the situation calmly before you strike. Acclimatize yourself fully to the local conditions and assess exactly how far it will be prudent for you to intervene in local political intrigues. As a means of disposing of opponents, assassination is often useful, but it's not the safest method.
Yes, Your Excellency.
Even more important is the art of acquiring influential friends.
I shall be most affable.
Affability alone is not enough. You will find that a few coins placed in the right hands can be most useful. You must never hesitate to bribe, with discrimination and tact, of course.
Of course.
If you cannot make a friend, you can generally buy him. The important thing is that you secure your objectives. How you do this is a matter of small concern. Is all that clear?
Perfectly.
That will be all, then. You may leave.
Your Excellency.
Oh, yes. You are, of course, taking your cook along with you.
Cook, my prince? But I have no cook.
You will secure one. We cannot risk your being poisoned. Otherwise, you will travel alone.
Except for my wife, of course.
No exceptions, particularly wives. They have a tendency to gossip.